Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Something all the great religions share. Music, sure, but look at your calendar, folks.
Punxsutawney Phil.
That's right, woodchuck chuckers. It's Groundhog Day!
Groundhog Day, the movie, not the holiday. Since the Bill Murray film was released, it has entered a netherworld of cult worship and hidden meaning and spiritual significance.
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
Deja vu, immortality, what is the meaning of life, all the great themes. Groundhog Day, screenplay as scripture.
Am I right or am I right? Am I right?
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, February 2nd, and I guarantee your takeaway from today's program is going to be how Groundhog Day, the movie, released back in 1993, has become this redemptive religious story followed by all kinds of religions.
No personal bias involved in this at all,
no,
but it's clearly a Buddhist film.
Buddhist film. There we go. We will have a discussion later on.
Let's get right to the top stories you're following this morning. Medical evacuation flights for injured Haitians are now in the air again after U.S. officials decided to fly the wounded to several states so that Florida won't be overloaded. They'd been suspended since last week when Florida's Governor Charlie Crist said the state's hospitals were reaching the saturation point. But Crist says the state never turned anyone away.
Florida never said that we wanted to stop taking Haitians. All we said was that we would appreciate help in being able to continue to help our friends from the island. And that's exactly what has happened.
The federal government will now reimburse American hospitals who treat earthquake victims. Haiti's prime minister says the 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country without proper documents should be put on trial for child trafficking. He says the group knew it was breaking the law, especially since some of the children have surviving parents. For a quick update on this story, George Prentice joins us now. He's a reporter and host for Boise State Radio, where the church in question is based. George, a church with a busload of kids and some questionable paperwork there in Haiti, is this a case of bureaucracy down there or over-exuberant missionaries who believe they are doing God's work? How's it being reported in your neck of the woods?
Well, the answers, I guess, would be yes and yes if you ask two different people. There's very little middle ground. Some say God wanted them to go to Haiti, and others are saying it's incredibly wrong-headed and no wonder the world hates us.
Another religious story, and we're going to get to the bottom of it in just a moment. George Prentice, stay with us.
Now for the latest on the massive Toyota recall. Toyota President Jim Lentz says a small steel shim about the size of a postage stamp is all that's needed to fix the problem with accelerators.
The parts will be arriving in dealerships. If not late on Tuesday, they will begin arriving on Wednesday. All of the training should be completed by the end of the week, so they will start working on consumer vehicles this weekend.
Toyota says the repairs take about a half hour.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates is expected to announce today a year-long study on allowing gays to openly serve in the military. President Obama called on Congress to repeal the 1993 Don't Ask, Don't Tell law. Democrats say they want more guidance on how the upheavals in the military can be avoided. It is Groundhog Day, as I mentioned, and this hour, Punxsutawney Phil and the crowds are already gathering. The weather forecasting groundhog is going to emerge to check for his shadow. As the legend goes, if he sees it, we're in for six more weeks of winter. And stay tuned for a religious discussion of the movie Groundhog Day. Asian and European markets are up, so are futures. The Dow gets underway at 10,185. The S&P opens at 1,089. The NASDAQ opens at 2,171. The religious significance of Groundhog Day, the screenplay writer who had no idea where this movie was going to go, will be with us later on.
Yeah, imagine his surprise. We're also talking about how to give the unemployed a helping hand. When someone close to you is unemployed, how can you help them? And if you are unemployed, what can people do to help you?
Hey, it's Michelle calling from Atlanta. The one thing that I would like for my friends to do since I'm laid off is not call me at 8 in the morning asking what I'm doing.
Look, give us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
With all of the headlines coming out of Haiti since the devastating earthquake 3 weeks ago, this has become an international incident. The question of what the Central Valley Baptist Church workers were doing with a busload of Haitian kids at the border of the Dominican Republic without proper documentation. The church members have been detained. There are now questions about what they were actually trying to do with the kids. Here's Clint Henry, the pastor of the Central Valley Baptist Church, speaking yesterday.
We were not trying to traffic children. We were simply trying to minister to a desperate situation there in that country, and we had a facility that could be used to do that temporarily.
Haitian authorities, on the other hand, say the group didn't have proper documentation for the children, and they say some of the children weren't even orphans. The group, based in Idaho, says, as you heard there, they were only trying to help. Getting to the bottom of this is difficult, and we're rejoined by George Prentice, a reporter and host for Boise State Radio in Idaho, who laid out there at the top of the hour just how difficult it is to get clarity here. You're feeling that as well as a reporter, right, George?
You bet. Definitely both sides of the issue, but very little middle ground.
All right. Michelle Montaz is a former U.N. spokeswoman for the Secretary General in New York, a former director of Radio Haiti, and she's a Haitian journalist. Good morning to you, Michelle.
Good morning, John.
Let's talk about, first of all, how this is being reported down in Haiti.
Well, you know, I think it is being reported for what it is. I mean, those, you know, no matter what their intentions were, those were people trying to take children out at a time when, you know, there are a number of cases of children being trafficked out of Haiti. There are a number of reports that were alarming. And there are the reason why it was done is because they didn't have proper documentations. I also know of a number of orphans who have left with proper documentations. They were their papers were signed by the Prime Minister himself so they could go. So some have left on a regular basis, on a legal basis.
Indeed. And since the earthquake, the Prime Minister has to sign for every child who leaves the country. George Prentice, what is the reputation of the Central Valley Baptist Church? And would you expect them to be involved in something like this, you know, that's not above board?
Well, the church is a member of the Southern Baptist Convention, and that's the country's largest Protestant denomination. They're also known for humanitarian programs. But this particular initiative was a nonprofit. A couple of ladies started it called the New Life Children's Refuge, and they just started it last fall. So this is pretty loosey-goosey right now.
Now, when you say loosey-goosey, it means it's not accredited, it's not clear what the mission is, or these are people who are so imbued with the sense of doing God's work that maybe they're inclined to break the rules?
Certainly, while they are accredited, there is no defined mission, and one of the members who is actually being detained in Haiti right now says God wanted us to come here to help children.
Well, that can't be helpful to shorten their detention, I would imagine, at this point. Michelle Montaz, what is the interest of the Haitian government in trying to keep the impression from getting out that basically Haiti's children aren't safe in Haiti and that they need to be sent outside of the country?
Well, no one it has nothing to do with the government. No one is safe in Haiti. We had a tremendous event that occurred on January 12th. We had an earthquake. And we have aftershocks, and there are credible information that there might be more and more severe ones. So everyone is at risk in Haiti. However, you know, some children who lost their parents the day after the earthquake or the day of the earthquake, you know, some of the parents have been trying to trace their children and they have found them, okay? And everything is being done to help parents trace their children and find them. Okay, so to me, the fact that there is the impression that, you know, Haiti needs help. However, it's not a reason to go beyond the law. It has nothing to do with the government. It has to do with the law of the country.
Michelle Montaz, a former UN spokeswoman for the Secretary General in New York and a Haitian journalist speaking to us from Port-au-Prince. You know, is it possible that this organization will get the chance to make their paperwork right? Or do you think that organizations are coming to Haiti and taking advantage of the situation?
I think some have been very, very helpful. And all the children who had their paperwork already in the pipeline, they were all given the possibility to go and join their adoptive families in the States or elsewhere. So there is a process which was ongoing. Right now it's a bit difficult to initiate new processes because, as you know, most of the judicial system, at least in Port-au-Prince, collapsed. However, there is a judge that heard these missionaries, and the process is ongoing. Whether they can be tried in Haiti or in the States, it's something that has not been determined yet. For the time being, they were breaking Haitian law.
Right. Well, let's listen to here's a George Willett, who you may have seen on some of the cable programs, who's been speaking publicly. He's from the SOS orphanage in Haiti. And the Associated Press interviewed him talking about some of the children who were obtained from the custody of the Central Valley Baptist Church. And he describes, first of all, their situation. Listen to this. Well, he describes it. Let me just quote him. "I am not an orphan," quoting one of the girls. "I do have my parents, although I was going to a school or a boarding camp, and we don't know exactly where, to the Dominican Republic." And there were babies that were dehydrated, according to this individual, that the Red Cross had looked at some of the health of these individuals and said they needed immediately to go to the hospital. George Prentice, do you have any sense there in Boise if this church has attempted to intercede to U.S. authorities to try to get themselves released?
Well, I can tell you that the Idaho congressional delegation, our two senators and two House members, came out with what could easily be considered a carefully crafted statement, saying that they were in touch with the State Department, et cetera, to represent the interests, if you will, of the Central Valley Baptist Church.
So, George, you're all over this story. What do you want people around the country to know about the relationship between this group and your community?
Other Northwest adoption agencies are really concerned about the shadow this is casting on them. They're saying the last thing that anyone would want is for a child to come here and then find out that father or mother is actually alive.
All right. George Prentice, reporter and host for Boise State Radio, which is where Central Valley Baptist Church is located. The individuals from that church are being detained. Michelle Montaz, thanks so much for being with us.
You're most welcome, John.
Michelle is former UN spokeswoman for the Secretary General in New York, and she's working in Haiti trying to sort out the situation there as a Haitian journalist and also spokesperson for the government. And at 15 minutes after the hour, we're going to check in on the other stories we're following this morning.
Still staying with Haiti, the U.S. military will begin flying injured survivors to several U.S. hospitals. That's after Florida's governor said his state's hospitals were being overloaded. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke with Dr. Mark McKinney, a surgeon who traveled to Haiti. He says in other catastrophes, foreign medical teams provide emergency relief, and then the local hospitals and doctors take over.
In Haiti, that's not happening. Many of the surgeons and nurses were killed. The hospitals are not functioning normally, and it's a difficult transition.
For now, American hospitals will be reimbursed for treating Haitian victims.
President Barack Obama urging Congress today to approve his $3.8 trillion budget. It raises the deficit to a record $1.6 trillion, but the president says right now he needs to focus on stimulating the economy, not reducing the deficit. Toyota will use a small steel shim to repair vehicles affected by that massive recall. Here's Toyota President Jim Lenz.
We are very confident that this will stop the issues of acceleration caused by entrapment of a pedal.
Toyota says the repair will get you in and out of the dealership inside of an hour. The problem is costing the automaker about $155 million a week in lost sales, though. And speaking of big money, the average price for a 30-second Super Bowl commercial, maybe Toyota will have a few of those in the Super Bowl, is about $3 million. And CBS says, sorry, folks, too late. Ads are sold out.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we talked about a little-known fact about stem cell research. Guess what? Very few of the cells that they use in that research come from minorities. That's having a big impact on research, and we'll talk about it more in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
And I'll take three news takeouts, and two of them are right here in the studio. Louise Story, business and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is also here with a sports takeout a little bit later in the segment. Good morning.
Good morning.
Louise, let's begin with you. The inspector general, a guy by the name of Neil Barofsky, I'm sure he's a fine, fine fellow, but these inspector generals are sort of paid to be very, very critical, had a controversial thing to say about the TARP program. He is actually the person who is responsible for oversight of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, along with some others. But Neil Barofsky described the TARP as having saved our financial system from driving off a cliff back in 2008, but absent meaningful reform, we are still, the U.S. economy, driving on the same winding mountain road, but this time in a faster car. It sounds like he's warning that we're in worse shape, maybe, than we were a year ago.
He is, John. What he's saying is that, you know, this too big to fail thing we've set up where everyone assumes now that if a bank gets in trouble, the government will bail it out, actually has the moral hazard of perhaps encouraging banks to take more risk because they know that they'll be saved. This guy, Neil Barofsky, is really interesting. He's kind of like the Kenneth Starr, you know, from the Clinton administration.
Right, sure.
He's a former U.S. attorney, and you know what he used to do was fight Colombian drug lords.
Oh, so
he's an interesting, tough person.
Yeah.
In fact, he apparently keeps the knife from someone who tried to kill him down in Colombia over his former work. So these banks, you know, should be a little afraid of him. But he has really taken some tough positions. He's accused the former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson of misleading the public about how bad the situation was in 08. He's been the only one who's required the banks under oath to tell us exactly how they spent those bailout funds. And so now for him to take this position that really nothing has changed, the government has not put anything meaningful in place to rein these banks in, either with pay or with financial reform, and he says that's very dangerous.
Well, demoralizing, and we will see if anything happens as a result of this Inspector General report. Louise Story, business and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks.
Our next takeout comes to us from the laboratories of the University of Michigan. We have with us Sean Morrison. He's the director of the school's Center for Stem Cell Biology. And they think they've identified a frightening trend in research that could lead to some major breakthroughs in Parkinson's, cancer, or multiple sclerosis treatments. Joining us is Sean Morrison. So, Sean, what is it you found as you looked through the current stem cell research?
Well, under the Bush administration policy, very few stem cell lines were available for research. And of those, nobody really knew which human populations they were derived from. So we tested the most commonly used lines genetically and found that the vast majority of the lines were of European origin. A few were from the Middle East, probably from Israeli populations, and a few were from Asia, but they did not represent the diversity in our society, and there were certain populations that were notably underrepresented, like anybody of African descent.
Why does it matter? Does there make a difference between one cell and another?
Well, a fundamental principle of medical research is that we test new therapies on diverse patients because we never know when therapies could affect patients from different human populations differently. And so if embryonic stem cell research has the potential to change the future of medicine, we should be able to study diverse lines to make sure that the therapies that are developed have the intended effects in diverse backgrounds.
Do you know why we don't have diverse stem cells, and does that help you know how to fix it?
Well, in the first instance, we just needed to derive lines to be able to do the research, and we had very few available. Now, under the new National Institutes of Health policy, many new lines will be available to federally funded researchers, and now's the time when we can start considering issues like ensuring appropriate diversity exists out there. And for, I think, one of the steps that will be necessary would be to derive new lines for underrepresented groups, such as from people of African descent, to make sure that they're adequately represented in the research, and that's something we'd like to do at the University of Michigan.
That's interesting. Thanks so much. Sean Morrison is the director of the University of Michigan's Center for Stem Cell Biology.
Well, he's counting the hours here in the studio. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Super Bowl is on Sunday, right?
Yes, exciting.
And every day leading up to the Super Bowl, we're going to profile interesting players who have great stories to tell. We also have a basketball milestone in a moment. But first, the Saints, Jahari Evans, is that how you pronounce
Jahari
his name?
Evans.
Jahari Evans. What's the story with him?
So he's an offensive lineman, which is he protects the quarterback.
Got
and
it.
He plays for the New Orleans Saints. In 2006, he came to the New Orleans Saints, which was a band of misfits. And he had previously been at Bloomsburg in Pennsylvania, which is a small Division II school, which is not quite the place that you normally get an NFL prospect. In high school, he had badly fractured his leg. Nobody was looking at him. So he ended up at this Division II school. He excels at this Division II school. And then somehow scouts came around him and picked him up, and they pulled him up. And the Saints took a chance on him. As a rookie, because of injuries to the veterans, he immediately was thrust into the starting position. And now he's on a team of destiny.
And he's an all-pro.
He's an all-pro.
So he goes from fractured knee at a bad school to essentially a walk-on with the Saints, the misfit Saints, and now he's an all-pro on his way to the Super Bowl.
And when he was in high school, he was a top 10 in his class. He had well over 1,000 in the SATs. So he's also a very likable guy. He really took to Bloomsburg. He goes back every year. He does a camp for offensive linemen. And in the beginning of the season, we talked about the importance of offensive linemen. And with a guy like quarterback Drew Brees behind you, you have to have a solid offensive line, and he's the anchor of that
he's
line.
He's the protector. Can you book him on the show? Sounds like a great guy.
He does let's sound like him. A great guy.
Give him let's a call. Him. All right, get started on that. But let's talk about this milestone. Kobe Bryant becomes the Lakers' all-time points leader with 44 points last night.
He has more points than George Mikan, Jerry West, Elgin Baylor, Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Wilt Chamberlain. And for the NBA franchise that's arguably one of the most dominant franchises sports history,
sure.
The Los Angeles Lakers, now Kobe Bryant is the leading scorer out of that group, and that's an astounding achievement.
That is so huge. Is that because of his longevity? Is that because of his per-game average? What?
I think it's also because he started before all of them. He came straight out of high school, so let's not forget that.
Okay, so he had that advantage.
Exactly.
But still an enormous milestone. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, thanks so much. Those are your takeouts. Coming up, we've been talking about how to rebuild Haiti. Today we talk about rebuilding housing. More in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the challenge of rebuilding Haiti. Do you get structures up quickly or do you make them last? We're going to talk about that in a few moments. Also, all day today, we're thinking about how to help the unemployed. When one of them is close to you, a loved one, how do you help them? Or if you're unemployed right now, what's the one thing that you need your friends to do or maybe not do?
I have a friend who keeps pushing me into waitressing work, and I'm like, I have never waitressed in my life.
That's what one unemployed person told us this morning. What's your story? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it on our site, thetakeaway.org. Here's some of the news stories that we're following now at 30 minutes after the hour. The U.S. military says it will fly injured Haitian earthquake survivors to several states. That's to avoid overloading Florida. Governor Charlie Crist describes the cost incurred by his state.
After about 3 days, it was about 1.7 million. After about a week, it was 7.1 million. And we're probably at approximately $10 million to date.
The government will also now start reimbursing hospitals who treat earthquake victims. Meanwhile, Haitian officials are considering a trial for the 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country without proper documents. The Haitian prime minister says the Americans knew they were breaking the law, especially since some of the children have surviving parents. No charges have been filed.
President Obama's budget may face an early test this week on Capitol Hill. The proposed tax credit for small businesses could come up for a vote in the Senate by Friday. Today, White House Budget Director Peter Orszag will appear before Congress to explain the ballooning deficit.
We don't want to act too rapidly to bring down the deficit because that would exacerbate the jobs deficit.
Also this morning, the president heads to New Hampshire to promote his idea to funnel $30 billion to community banks so they can help small businesses with the lending and credit. It's coming up on the first anniversary of a regional airliner crash near Buffalo, New York that killed 50 people when a plane hit a house. But key safety reforms still haven't been implemented. Lawmakers had promised swift action after the crash, which revealed a safety gap between major airlines and regional carriers. The National Transportation Safety Board meets today to talk about that crash. And Toyota's recalled gas pedal problem is costing the automaker some $155 million a week in lost sales. It's too soon to estimate how much the actual cost of the recall will be, but some reports have the number at $1 billion. Let's check markets now. Asian and European markets are up, so are futures. The Dow gets underway at 10,185. The S&P opens at 1,089. And the NASDAQ begins trading on Wall Street at 21.71. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Yesterday on the show, we started a conversation about how Haiti can transform itself and transition from rescue efforts into long-term rebuilding. We spoke to economist Paul Collier about that process, and we asked him what the triggers are for long-term economic sustainability.
First, let's look for sustainable housing. So not tents, but simple one-room buildings that can then be expanded down the line. Let's look for those houses to be located in places where economic opportunity can be built.
Okay, how do you actually make that happen? We have somebody here with the answers to that question. Andreas Duwani is an architect from Miami. He was involved in the reconstruction after Katrina, and he just returned from Haiti 2 days ago. Good morning, Andreas.
Hello, good morning.
So do you agree with what you just heard from economist Paul Collier, that you need to find simple, sustainable building solutions so that that eventually leads to long-term recovery?
You know, I think so. I think actually just about every idea for the time being is a good one. But in the end, the one sustainable thing, given the very large numbers and problems, the scale of the problems, is to harness the energy of the people, you know, the people themselves and their smarts. You know, I think the Haitians, from what I could tell, were clever, self-organizing people that, given the chance, will dig themselves out.
Okay, but this is an urgent issue at the moment because you have two warring problems. You have, number one, an issue of urgency that people need shelter now. Hurricane season is coming. Rains are coming. Mm-hmm. And the other is that you have to build something, some kind of structures for them that can actually survive hurricane season.
Well, there are lots of structures. And I was studying aerial photography yesterday, from Google. You should know that Google Earth has actually photographed Port-au-Prince after the hurricane. After the earthquake.
Wow.
You know, they have very recent photographs. And what's astonishing is the pattern of masonry buildings haven't fallen. You know, what most people visit is the downtown with masonry buildings. But then you look at the shanty towns on the hillside, which are built out of more resilient materials, you know, metal and wood. And what you find is huge areas that are intact. And these are the kinds of structures that people from the outside never consider. You know, they always consider, let's have the permanent solid structures. And, while there's a huge areas of shanty towns that have not yet been visited, you know, I've asked people and said, no, we haven't penetrated that area. We don't know what's happening there. But the aerial photography shows that entire areas have survived. And these are the hand-built structures of the people themselves.
So rather than bringing in tents, should we be investing in structures that can be put up very quickly and easily and, I assume, inexpensively, that perhaps can survive the elements?
Well, no, I don't think there's a rather. I think we need to build in tents. We need to bring in tents, and we need to bring in prefabricated buildings of all technologies. But when you think about that the largest, proposals are maybe 500 units, you know, 1,000 units, and there could easily be 100,000 and 200,000 people in need of housing, I think that the answer is everything must be done, but not least let people build for themselves the way they're used to. Even if to our eyes it looks incredibly impoverished, you know, and incredibly sad, you know, those little shanty town structures are really survived.
No, and they have experience. They have experience in precisely those conditions. I guess, you know, we've talked with people from Architecture for Humanity on this program, and they talk a good game about what's needed in Haiti. I'm wondering if there's a way to create what Paul Collier talked about yesterday, this sort of staircase of architecture, where you begin with a tent, but then the tent becomes part of maybe a building that becomes more of a traditional shanty dwelling. That so you can actually accumulate a dwelling rather than having to constantly throw things away.
Well, I think so. I'm not sure that tents can grow, but I do think that, for example, a pile of bulk deliveries of 2x4s, you know, and piles of corrugated iron, which is what they make the roofs and walls out of. Corrugated steel, and maybe, you know, wire to slash things together. Just delivering piles of these things would actually yield to a lot of energy being applied, you know, by people themselves. Now, there is one caveat, which is these are very poor people, and they're, you know, it's more likely than not that they'll just sell the stuff, you know, that will become into a kind of form of very minor graft. So we have two contradictory things here. We have the people's ability to do for themselves, but also the need to make sure that they land in the right things.
Now, how is this different than the experience that you had in rebuilding Katrina? Are you seeing some of the same issues?
Well, no, Katrina, you know, the little houses, the so-called Katrina cottages, of which 3,000, for example, were delivered in Mississippi, those are palaces by Haiti standards, you know. The very wealthiest people live in what in Mississippi is a temporary Katrina cottage. So, you know, I've designed already four types of housing for, you know, almost one a day. And what I have to do is recalibrate downwards. You know, I designed something that seems very simple and very, you know, and then I realize that these people are even poorer than that. This morning I read about a woman in the New York Times that had an 8-foot by 8-foot shelter built for four people for $60.
Wow.
You know, and even after 4 days, I have not calibrated downwards to that.
But could it withstand a hurricane? That's the question.
Well, it's got flexibility.
Andreas Duane is an architect from Miami. He was involved in the reconstruction after Katrina. He also returned from Haiti just 2 days ago. Thank you so much.
$60. Wow.
I would be afraid to be in a house in bad weather in a $60 home.
It's all about sort of recalibrating downward. That's how you understand what's going on in Haiti.
Okay, coming up, Christians, Buddhists, Jews, and more unite. Today is for you. Here's a hint as to why. The movie Groundhog Day is the intersection of many faiths. Honestly, we're going to talk about that in a little bit. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry, trying to imagine a soft drink with the name of Rumsfeld, okay? Rumsfeld. Drink Rumsfeld, right?
Yeah.
It would take some rehabilitation for the former defense secretary to possibly be popular enough to have a beverage named after him, but not so Joe Stalin. Boris Maximov joins us. He's a BBC Russian services editor. He's on the line from Bush House in London to describe that Russia has started producing Stalin-logoed sodas to mark a World War II military anniversary. Boy, if Rumsfeld needs some rehabilitation, Joe Stalin certainly needs some, but it sounds like he's doing pretty well right now in Russia. Boris?
Yes, he's doing pretty well because there's been a fairly concerted campaign over the last 10 years from the authorities, from the top down, to kind of rehabilitate him. For example, you know, they changed the history school books because history is being taught as a compulsory subject for all the children in schools. And they rewrote them, and now it mentions in one sentence that he did kill quite a few people, but how many exactly is disputed. And then it stresses that he was a very effective manager. And sure, he was not perfect, but he was very good at running the country.
This is what the school books say. It doesn't say that on the drink bottle or anything.
No, but... for example, as a result of that campaign, it's been going on for almost 10 years now, or trying to rehabilitate an idea of a strong, effective leader who will save the country and move it somewhere, guess whom they're hinting at. There was the campaign to restore Stalin to at least some kind of glory. So his pictures suddenly appeared at least on one subway station in Moscow recently. One of his statues recently appeared somewhere. There was vodka called Stalin for quite a few years now. And if you listen to opinion polls, for example, in Russia, ordinary Russians are being asked who in Russian history in 20th century or 19th century was one of the main great heroes of the country, they invariably mention Stalin in the top three or four. And in the latest opinion poll on the subject, they mention Stalin and Solzhenitsyn at exactly the same level, which is kind of somewhat ironic because Solzhenitsyn spent his time denouncing Stalin's crimes.
Now, you know, Lenin, of course, has been a trade figure for quite a long time. Why do you think this particular brewery took, or particular beverage manufacturer took this step?
Because they read the same opinion polls as I just quoted you, and if somebody is popular, so it's not at least among a larger section of population.
No, I understand, but why are they first? Why did they step out first? Do they have a reputation for being conservative or a reputation for being edgy?
Neither. They just want to be popular. Because I told you, you know, there was Stalin vodka been around for a while, and not just in Russia. I've seen a Coca-Cola bottling plant in neighboring Georgia that produced simultaneously Coca-Cola and vodka called Stalin.
So, Boris Maximov, what does Stalin, the drink, taste like?
Well, I suspect that it tastes a lot of like any other soft drink, kind of gassy chemical.
a gassy chemical. But, I mean, is it going to be really sweet, or is it going to be sort
it
of
is
sour?
Sweet.
Russia,
of course it is sweet. Russians have a sweet tooth. You know, give enough sweetness and enough drink, and the country's happy.
So next time you go back to Moscow, you're going to bring some out?
Probably not. There are better things to take out from there.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll get you on the show to talk about that next time. Boris Maximov, BBC Russian Service Editor. Thanks so much. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, what you've been waiting for when The Takeaway asks the really big questions.
If you only had one day to live, what would you do with it?
It's from the movie Groundhog Day. The movie, since 1993, has become something of a parable of redemption for a lot of religions. And we're serious about that. We're going to find out why and talk with the screenwriter of the movie in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour now. President Obama wants Congress to act fast to approve his nearly $4 trillion budget. It raises the deficit to a record $1.6 trillion, but the president says his main concern is improving the economy. But that doesn't mean his administration will be wasteful.
We've gone through every department spending, line by line, item by item, looking for inefficiency, duplication, and programs that have outlived their usefulness.
President Obama's budget proposal includes $300 billion for recession relief and job creation. The U.S. military will begin flying injured Haitian earthquake victims to American hospitals in several states to avoid overloading Florida. The federal government will reimburse the hospitals for treatment they provide. Also on Haiti, 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country without proper documents may be heading for trial. This orphanage spokesman quotes one of the kids who reportedly told him,
I'm not an orphan. I do have my parents. I thought I'm going to a boarding school or to a summer camp. We don't know it exactly, to the Dominican Republic.
The Haitian prime minister says the Americans, affiliated with a church in Idaho, knew they were breaking the law, and some of the children have surviving parents.
And finally, is winter over? Let's ask Punxsutawney Phil, the weather-predicting groundhog.
After casting a joyful eye towards thousands of his faithful followers, Phil proclaimed, as the sky shines bright above me, my shadow I see beside me. 6 more weeks of winter it will be.
It's maybe a good time to point out that the groundhog is actually only correct 40% of the time. We're going to have more on Groundhog Day, the movie, in just a moment. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
So what do you do when you're going to have a religious ceremony? You sacralize the space. Listen to that music. Sacred music? No. It's Sonny and Cher, but it is the music that iconically evokes that moment at 6 a.m. when Bill Murray wakes up again and again and again in the movie Groundhog Day. It is Groundhog Day today, and the holiday is not what we're going to talk about, but the movie is something we're going to talk about because the movie has become, since it was released in 1993, something of a cult legend, and for reasons that we're going to explore. I mean, it does ask all the right questions.
Rita, if you only had one day to live, what would you do with it?
I don't know, Phil. What are you dying of?
No. I mean, the whole world is about to explode. What do you do?
I just want to know where to put the camera.
Asking big questions, kind of a romantic comedy, but also having this spooky sort of deja vu, it happens over and over and over again kind of special effect, transported this movie, for reasons we don't quite understand, into something way beyond simply a cult flick or a vehicle for Bill Murray. Angela Zito joins us. She's co-director of the NYU Center for Religion and Media. She's right here in the studio. Angela Zito, is this a parable of redemption, and why do religious groups identify with this text and this story?
Well, I guess I'd say the quick answer to that one would be yes. And what's interesting is that so many different groups seem to identify with it. I myself have taught the film at the end of an Introduction to Buddhism class.
Really?
So, yes. So that is the angle at which I come to it.
But list the religions, the many religions you say that have adopted this story or have at least investigated.
Well, Jews seem to be very interested in it. Certainly Christians. I've heard Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog himself, you know, compared to the risen Christ sort of out of pagan traditions, you know, the rising of spring, so on.
And there are origins there, absolutely, historical origins there. Well, the stone tablets guy in this story is Danny Rubin, the screenwriter of Groundhog Day. He joins us from Massachusetts. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, John.
So you didn't come down from the mountain with this screenplay, did you?
I actually did write it on a stone tablet. took a while.
Did you have any idea that this would be the result? I mean, you, Howard Ramis, Bill Murray, I don't necessarily associate you guys with, a religious cult or...
You just don't know us well enough.
I know.
No, of course not. I mean, it was just trying to be honest with the original premise of the story and being honest to the character, and that's... it was very gratifying that it was embraced by so many people in that way because we knew it wasn't just a simple comedy.
Now, how did you know it wasn't just a simple comedy? What told you that?
Well, when I came up with the idea, I wasn't interested in the premise as a simple comedy about a guy just repeating the same day, even though I knew that that was funny and had a lot of good ideas in it. It wasn't until I started thinking about people and humanity, and it was always a young man's journey through life. If a person could live long enough and unencumbered by history, what would be the result? How would they change? So at the very heart of it, it was always a very human story.
And that really is the classic core of this story, Angela Zito, someone who gets the chance to relive their life and what they might do differently. That's sort of the redemption.
Well, it certainly is about repetition, and religions think about repetition somewhat differently. Buddhists of the Mahayana Greater Vehicle Tradition, that's like Zen, Tibetan Buddhists, so on, they think that we are all here until we manage to get it right. So there will be constant reincarnation.
So there it's the repetition. The repetition is That's interesting. So it's not simply corrective; it's improvement.
It's improvement.
Interesting.
And you get the chance over and over again. First of all, to notice that you're repeating, and this is something that Bill Murray does notice. No one around Bill Murray notices that the day is repeating.
And when he finally comes to a conclusion of what the heck is going on here, here's what he concludes about himself. Listen,
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god. I'm not the god. I don't think.
Because you survived a car wreck? You folks ready to order?
I didn't just survive a wreck. I wasn't just blown up yesterday. I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted, and burned.
Oh, really?
And every morning I wake up without a scratch on me, not a dent in the fender. I am an immortal.
So, Danny Rubin, you wrote that line. Were you thinking Job there, or were you thinking Terminator?
Oh, well... I was just thinking that that was his character with his kind of ego would come to that conclusion and then kind of grow beyond it to the point where he realized, well, I may be a god, I may not be a god, it doesn't matter, I'm still stuck here. There are still limitations to what I can do.
You know, Danny, you were saying that you were just examining the character, but, you know, the funny thing for me is the place where it actually realistically becomes about a religion is that he has to get it right to a certain extent. Like, you're looking for the right answers from him before the whole roller coaster ends. He's going to keep doing it over and over again till he says the right things and does the right things. There's a right answer here.
I don't know if that's true, but it sure seems that way because of where the movie ends.
Right.
What if the movie went on for another 2 hours?
See, that's what I was afraid of when I watched it.
Really, most people enjoy it.
No, I totally enjoyed it, but I trying to imagine this repetition, I went, this feels like it might be a prison. How's he going to deal with that? Of course, you dealt with it brilliantly. Angela Zito, what is the most unusual sort of interpretation that you found in your teachings?
Apparently it is considered to be really a kind of mandatory viewing for Wiccans, because Groundhog Day is one of their, you know, four-time Sabbath holidays, like the holidays that come during the year between the equinox and the solstice.
Now, remind us who the Wiccans are. Well, they're not witches. Are
not
they?
Witches. No, these are people who are interested in old pagan gods of say Northern Europe.
And was that the elevator pitch, Danny Rubin? We're going to get the Wiccans when we did this movie.
that's the one that got the studio on board.
Well, it's amazing. Congratulations, Danny Rubin. Happy Groundhog Day. I imagine it's a popular holiday in your household.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, Danny Rubin is the screenwriter of Groundhog Day. And Angela Zito, thanks so much for coming to the studio. Co-director of the NYU Center for Religion and Media. Groundhog Day, who would have thought?
You know, I'm wondering out there if you're listening, if Groundhog Day has had that kind of meaning for you, or if maybe there's another movie that has that kind of significance. A Big Lebowski, maybe? Reach us at 8778 My Take. We're also asking you about how to help other people, maybe not religiously, but if you have friends who are unemployed, how can you help them? What is it that you do for them? Or if you are unemployed, what do you need in terms of help from your friends and family? Let us know your story at 8778 My Take, or post it to our website at thetakeaway.org. We also need your help. Super Bowl's coming up, and we're asking you, if your congressman going? And if so, can you help us find out how he or she got the tickets for it? Let us know at our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Am I right or am I right? Or am I right?
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.